Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to EB5 Investment Voice. We have a special guest for you today, but before we introduce him, I'd like to bring on Mona Shaw.
Hello, everybody, and hello, Mark.
Yeah, Mona, I'm excited to have our guest on today. I realize that we have Jeff Carr, and he's going to be talking to us about understanding targeted employment areas, as well as perhaps some job creation.
Yes, we are. I'm very lucky to have Jeff. Welcome, Jeff.
I'm delighted to be here, although, you know, to be excited to have an economist in and of itself may say.
Well, you know, Freakonomics is a huge podcast. We're just trying to, you know, bump them off. That's really what we're doing here. Not at all.
Where would we be in EB5 without an economist?
Right. I always say that.
Jeff, if you could, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm president and senior economist of Economic and Policy Resources, which is an applied economics firm that's goes back in EB5 to 1997, but of course most of our work has happened in the last 10 or 11 years. So we've done work in 42 states. We've helped create about 50 regional centers. We've done analyses that have helped over 1,000 I-526 petitions be approved. We've also been involved with more than 200 approvals of I-29 investor petitions. And if you total it all up over the last 11 years, we've been involved in about $14 billion worth of EB5 capital investment projects, and the investment goes through between now and the time that the projects end. We will have been involved in creating a little less than 100,000 jobs.
Wow. That just sounds enormous. And Mark, I have to tell you that I've been working with Jeff. We're both members of the Public Policy Committee at IUSA, and we had an awful lot to do last year with the draft policy. And Jeff was wonderful in explaining so much about TEAs and nuances. I couldn't think of a better person to have on the show.
Definitely. If you can go up on the Capitol Hill and talk about targeted employment areas and the economic analysis that, for example, those 100,000 jobs, and you can explain that to, well, a legislator, you're definitely the right person for this show, because maybe I'll understand.
Well, we'll try.
Well, first of all, Jeff, I do want to bring that before we even get into TEA, I get this question all the time, interestingly, from attorneys as well as investors and developers. They don't really understand the differences with regards to the job creation between direct pooled projects and RCs. Everybody seems to understand with an entrepreneur petition that, you know, you create 10 jobs for yourself, but with a direct pooled where you have a number of people in there and it's a direct project and not an RC, they still ask me to get an economist report.
Yeah, I mean, that really isn't necessary for a direct EB5 project, which, by the way, we know is the only permanent part of the EB5 program is the direct program. And the reason for that is, you know, a lot of times projects can get away with just counting the jobs that are created at the subject business that's part of the EB5 project. So we do things like supply W-2 reports in order to document the full-time jobs that go into the 10 jobs for investor math, but a lot of projects would really like to raise more EB5 capital than would be supported by just counting the new W-2 jobs at the subject business of the EB5 project. So then what we want to do is we want to broaden the counting of jobs using reasonable economic and statistical methodologies to count those multiplier effect jobs that happen beyond the business that's the subject of the EB5 project, and count the jobs that happen as a result of the suppliers, as a result of even the customers of these EB5 projects. And also what we like to do is we like to count the jobs in the supply chain so we can significantly broaden the number of jobs that can be brought into the 10 job per EB5 investor math, which allows projects to, quite frankly, just raise more money, which makes EB5 a bigger part of their capital stack, and in many cases allows projects to go forward because they're able to have access to capital that perhaps they otherwise wouldn't be able to do through the traditional channels.
That's absolutely right, Jeff. And I really do think that what often happens is, especially with all of the controversies which happened last year, is that a lot of people don't understand job creation outside of a direct W-2 type of job. So they don't really understand the ripple effect of a project. If you put a project somewhere, how many people are actually impacted by the input of money? It's amazing. And it's only an economic report, really, which will show all of this. And it's true also, isn't it, that there are some politicians out there who don't even trust some of the indirect job counts.
Right. Many folks who are sometimes a little skeptical of the program, for whatever reason, sometimes challenge the calculations that go into counting the jobs that happen beyond the company. And for lack of better definitions, usually when you start to count the jobs that are beyond the company itself and the expansion and perhaps the development activity that's associated with the project, we count what economists refer to as economically indirect jobs. And those economically indirect jobs are the ones that are found at suppliers or the ones that are found when the employees at the new employees at the business or the employees that come about at, for example, suppliers go out and spend the income that they earn at those jobs and buy products, buy clothes, buy cars, send kids to school, go to the movies with their families, those types of things, buy groceries. Those are all jobs that can be brought into the equation. And so economists usually refer to the first order impact jobs, like the new jobs at the business that the EB-5 capital is going into, as the direct jobs. And then the jobs that are brought about by the multiplier effect are referred to as indirect jobs, of which induced jobs, a subsector of indirect jobs overall, are the jobs that are created by the income effect of the wages and salaries that are earned by the new jobs that are created at the project.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. I would like to add on to that as well for our listeners. Sometimes you do need to have an indirect job count when you have direct jobs just because of the corporate structure of a project. If the job creating entity isn't the same entity where the investors are actually putting their money, then those jobs, even if they are direct jobs, they aren't really counted as far as the W-2s. And so for that, you would have to go through the indirect method. So it is important there for all the skeptics. But we do want to keep a lot of your valuable information, Jeff, too, because we are having another podcast on job creation itself, because we really wanted to focus more on the TEAs in this particular episode.
Great. In that, we can start to talk about the two different definitions of direct and indirect job. There's one set of definitions on the immigration side, and then there's another set of definitions for direct and indirect that's a little bit different than the immigration definition, and we can get into that in more depth.
Jeff, let me ask you this. Before we get too much further, what is a targeted employment area?
Well, the targeted employment area is very important because if we can define the targeted employment area by either one of the ways that we can do that, the immigrant investor that's investing in the project qualifies for the reduced minimum capital investment. And right now, under current law, the default in the EB-5 program for an EB-5 investor to invest in a project is $1 million. If we can qualify the project to be located in a targeted employment area using either approach, then the immigrant investor qualifies for the lower investment minimum of $500,000 under current law under the program. There's a proposal, obviously, in EB-5 reform to change those investor amounts. But if you can qualify for the $500,000 project, most of the projects in the marketplace are $500,000 projects. And because the immigrant investor is looking for the immigration job benefits that allows them to become eventually, hopefully, an unconditional permanent resident of the United States, you don't want to be out in the marketplace as a project sponsor trying to find investors to get that same immigration benefit at a $1 million level when most of the other projects out there are at the $500,000 level under current law. Now, that could change in the various EB-5 reforms, but right now, the most prevalent minimum investment amount in the marketplace is $500,000 under the Regional Center Program. And I think, Mona, you've seen and I've seen and I participated in projects in the direct program where there's been some $1 million minimum investment projects that have succeeded. But in the Regional Center Program, in most cases, you have to be at the $500,000 level because as a project sponsor, it's very difficult to convince investors to pay you $1 million for the same immigrant benefits that can be obtained for $500,000 in most of the other projects.
Well, that's correct, Jeff. And I think this is really the crux of the argument because developers often find it difficult to understand. They say, well, why don't you just find me or let's find $10 million investors instead of $20, $500,000 investors. Well, there's a different thought rationale. First of all, a lot of the times this money is dead money for the investor. And why put $1 million away when you only need to put $500,000 away, even if you have it? The second thing is that this money is at risk. That means there's no guarantee you're going to get this money back. Again, why risk $1 million when you can just risk $500,000? But I think the third reason, and this we have seen over and over again, is that $500,000 being the cheapest in the whole world is very easy to obtain. You have people from all walks of life who have got an ability to get their hands on $500,000. A million, it's much, much harder because many of the immigrants coming are coming from an area where their capital will be a lot less, like a country's, where the actual dollar for dollar ratio, their dollar is, or their penny, or their currency is far less than the US dollar. And then on top of that, if they actually want to emigrate, then they have to keep enough money left over for a standard of living and living expenses. So these are all the factors which go into deciding whether somebody really wants to go into a $500,000 project or $1 million project.
Right. So it sounds like a targeted employment area really reduces that immigration investment hurdle. You know, right now from $1 million to $500,000, that may increase, but it'll probably still be less than $1 million. And because it lowers that hurdle, especially when you look at a regional center, it really impacts, well, the marketability of that regional center, because why invest in something for $1 million when you can invest in something for $500,000 when your main benefit really isn't so much your return on capital, but is that immigration status. So would you say that's a big benefit of the target employment area?
That is great, Mark, but there are projects out there who have benefited with $1 million, but there are far less investors in that particular project. Again, it just depends.
Yeah, I saw one report for regional centers. I think over 90% of the regional center investors were at the TEA level.
Right.
And I think that really, investor, I mean, there's lots of factors I can look at, but I think, is this a TEA investable project such that I can then invest only $500,000 vice $1 million? Or as Jeff indicated, that may increase. We're going to see what laws do, but it's probably still going to be less than $1 million. So, Jeff, is that the big benefit and why we should really care about what a targeted employment area is?
Well, I think, the only way that projects, in my experience, and Mona may have the same or different experience, raise money from investors at the $1 million level is a really special project or a project that wasn't terribly big that didn't use traditional marketing networks like they use a network of family and friends who are specifically interested not only in the immigration benefits, but also being a part of the business opportunity.
Yes, correct.
And that's a distinct minority of the roughly 7 or 8 dozen projects out there now. That's a distinct minority.
Right. And to me, that's more of a direct sales than an overall broad marketing, because you have a direct sales channel, like you said, through family or friends, vice having a broader marketing strategy that's competitive among the landscape of regional centers. Okay. Well, Jeff, you mentioned that there are two different types of targeted employment areas. Could we dive in a little bit of what those types are?
Sure. There's really only two ways you can qualify. You can qualify as a rural targeted area, or you can qualify if you're not in a rural area, and the rules are very explicit and very clear what a rural area is. If you're not in a rural area, you can only qualify for the $500,000 minimum investment as a targeted employment area if you're in a high unemployment rate targeted employment area. So when you talk about targeted employment areas in the U.S. cities and some of the other metro areas, you're talking about the high unemployment rate targeted employment area, where you can demonstrate that the unemployment rate in the most recent period that the state where you're located calculates it is at 150% of the U.S. average. In a rural area, you have to be outside of one of the U.S. Office of Management and Budget in the Office of the President metropolitan areas as defined, as they define them. There's about 385 to 400 of them out there right now. You can't be in any of those identified metro areas. So you have to be rural, and you can't be have your project located in a municipality that has more than 20,000 residents as of the most recent census, which in this case is the April 1st, 2010 U.S. Census. So to be rural, and actually it's good to be rural because, you know, you're rural for 10 years if you are in a rural area, or you're rural until the next census. So in this case, you're rural until at least 5 or 6 years. It takes them a little while after the date of the census to get the results out. You stay rural, and if you're in a municipality that's outside of a metro area as defined by the U.S. Office of Management and Budget, and you have a population of less than 20,000 in the city, town, or village that you're located in, you have targeted unemployment status until the results of the next census come out, or perhaps the U.S. Office of Management and Budget changes the definition of the metro areas, and they maybe snag your county that your project is in, but that doesn't happen very often either. It only happens 2 or 3 times over the course of a 10-year period. So to be rural is to be very stable and to have lots of certainty in your targeted employment area.
Well, Jeff, I know the answer to this. A lot of people are still very confused because you've given the absolute correct definition. However, what happens then when an urban city like Los Angeles, New York City, Miami can create TEAs?
The big thing for people to understand is that the unemployment rate calculation follows people who hold jobs, and it goes to where they live. A lot of people get confused about Los Angeles or New York. How can Lower Manhattan, with all the big Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch's, where all those high-paying jobs are located, how can they be areas of high unemployment? Well, the fact of the matter is we have to trace job holders back to the place where they live. A lot of the people who work for Goldman Sachs, for example, don't live in New York. They live in Westchester County, New York, or they live up in Connecticut. But the people who live in the area where those businesses are located, it's not jobs by place of work, it's job holders by place of residence, they can have pockets of very high unemployment, even amongst all those businesses with all those high-paying thousands of jobs like they have around the Wall Street area. And one of the ways that we can do that is we can follow the commuting patterns or the journey to work data that's published by the U.S. Census. And a lot of times we find, particularly for building, for example, a skyscraper in Lower Manhattan, that we can construct an area that captures the places where the people who hold the jobs that are in the construction trades, for example, which are relatively good paying jobs, where they come from. And a lot of times they come over from the Bronx. A lot of times they come from the northern part of the Manhattan borough. A lot of times they come in from other places in upstate New York because it's worth commuting to those places of work for the level of pay that they get. And we find lots of times that because the TEA in these metropolitan areas are based on where the workers live, not on the basis of the location of their jobs, we find that people come long ways to get these good paying jobs. And we find that we can put together counties or sub municipal areas like census tracts together when we blend them all together, we get an unemployment rate that qualifies. Now that's the way that it happens. Now not everybody agrees with that. I realize that is been a little bit of a subject of controversy. We have, hearings that have been held by the Senate and the House where they have been concerned about what they call gerrymandering of targeted employment areas. But many times, you know, when we look at the gerrymandering, it's only because the EB-5 program demands that all of the areas included in the TEA be contiguous, that we end up with funny looking TEAs, because in order to bring in where the people are coming from in the higher unemployment rate areas, we have to include all the census tracts and all the submunicipal areas in the area between where the project is located and where the people who work at the project live. If we would eliminate, for example, the need for all those census tracts to be contiguous, we may not have something that looks economically suspect. But because the program over the course of its time since you know, back in the early 90s as required targeted employment areas to include contiguous areas. That's how we come up with funny looking areas. And I think the other thing that happens, we did a TEA in Philadelphia for a project, for example. People criticized it because it looked like a blob with a bunch of spider legs. And the fact of the matter is the legs of that spider were all the major transportation thoroughfares. And so it makes sense because the people who commuted to the project through the various forms of transportation, whether it's mass transit or along the roadways, were coming from the areas that were adjacent to those roadways and then came to the project site. And so that explained what looked to most people who don't understand commuting patterns, a spider, but made an awful lot of sense economically. So as I'm fond of saying, gerrymandering is in the eyes of the beholder. If you're trying to do a project and your TEA looks funny when you look at it spatially, it's only because that's what we had to do to access the places where the workers were coming. And to people who are critical of it because they may not want to see projects happening in metro areas, we'll look at it and say, well, that doesn't make any sense. But if all the TEAs, by and large, are not put together in a way which are designed to exploit the program, but a lot of projects do what they do in order to be able to gain access to the capital, because without it, a lot of the projects wouldn't go forward at all, and many projects certainly wouldn't go forward on the accelerated timeline that the access to the EB-5 capital provides. And so a lot of the TEA question is, you know, what's your position? What is your dog in the EB-5 program fight? And to some people who, you know, are concerned about the big projects in the metro areas which are familiar to lots of immigrant investors, like people know New York, they know Los Angeles, they know San Francisco, they know Chicago. They don't know Jay, Vermont. They don't know East Podunk, Iowa.
So much of the controversy has come from this. I mean, yes, when you put two projects together, one in New York City and one in maybe a rural part of New Hampshire, where are the investors going to go? Yes, they're going to choose New York City, especially if they're both at the $500,000 level. But there is a lot more than just a familiarity. There is the fact that as your money is at risk, you have more chances of getting your money back in a high urban area where there is more viability. But the other big thing, which is you probably don't come across it the way we come across, is that if you are going to somewhere like China and you're paying agents, projects located in the urban areas have far more cash flow and are able to give a much better deal to an agent and thereby skew the market a little bit. Because now here's an agent, it's like a broker, some selling an apartment. If two people come by and ask that broker to sell their apartment and one person is saying, look, I'll give you 2% commission if you can sell my apartment, and another person's coming along and said, listen, I'll give you 6% commission. Where is that broker going to try the hardest? Of course, for the apartment that he's going to get a 6% commission on. And that's really where the situation is right now. And that's one of the main reasons behind so much of this controversy.
Well, that's the nut we have to crack.
Right.
And, you know, there may be ways to do that. And there were some suggestions in the reform debate to look at ways to do that. Some perhaps reduce the number of jobs per investor that are required for some of the riskier projects that tend to be in the non-urban areas and those types of things. And although I think those things should be on the table, the question that I don't think anybody really knows the answer to, Mona, is if you make the TEA requirements so that very few projects in the urban areas qualify for the lower investment amount, whether or not investors will then look more seriously at the non-urban projects, and we would still have a vibrant EB-5 program if that were the case. I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that.
Well, if you look back at statistics, and this is what the argument has been, Jeff, that before the big city projects came in, EB-5 had a lot less popularity. But then there are other factors which have accounted for EB-5 popularity other than just the big projects coming in. I'm a big believer in having a two-tier system. I do believe that if somebody wants a business class project, they need to pay a business class type of price. And if it's a little more, then so be it.
That may be how it eventually comes out, Mona. Your crystal ball is as good as mine.
Right, right. People don't always realize that there's a lot of competition to the U.S. After next year, Canada will reopen. Currently, there are quite a few European programs. So if an investor just wants to come out and have a new passport, and that's the purpose of him investing, then there are other options. If somebody specifically wants to come to the United States, then, of course, they will look and see what the best option for them is in their budget. Jeff, I do have a difficult question for you, though. I know it would involve a little bit of crystal balling. If the minimum amount, which is presently 500,000, should be increased to 800,000 or even a million, as you as economist, would you see less direct jobs? But as there's money left over because there's more investment put in, would there be more economic productivity? What are your thoughts on that?
Ooh, great question.
The interesting thing about that is it's a lot easier to create 10 jobs with $800,000 or $1 million than it is at $500,000. You know, that's one of the things that's happened over the course of time. And without the program ability to use both the EB-5 investment capital and the other sources of capital in the project to calculate the jobs and apply that to the EB-5 capital, a lot of projects would have had a much more difficult time if we could only use the EB-5 capital itself in the job creation. So at $800,000, it's ostensibly a $300,000 increase above the $500,000 level for the minimum investment amount. It's going to result in a lot more jobs per investor than was the case at the $500,000 level. And then I guess the other, you know, the other amount that was thrown around in last year's EB-5 reform debate for the default amount was $1.2 million. So actually they were going to reduce the spread from $500,000 to $400,000 between the default investment amount, the higher amount, and the TEA qualifying amount. The thought being there that $1.2 million, you can create a whole heck of a lot more jobs than $500,000, more than double. That would come from the investment amount per investor. So what you would do is you would have not necessarily more capital and overall invested in the project, but you might be able to have a higher percentage of EB-5 capital than the currently the market is allowing. And it would be a lot easier in terms of the number of jobs invested per created per investor for the higher investment amounts to reach the 10 jobs per investor marker that's put out there under the EB-5 program. So increasing the minimum investment amount will make it easier to come up with 10 jobs per investor. Not necessarily increase the amount of activity for each project, but you might be able to increase the percentage of EB-5 capital at the higher minimum investment amounts as a part of the total capital stack than had been the case in previous projects.
Yeah, and of course, you would actually have a lot less investors, or not a lot less, but quite a few less investors.
A significantly fewer amount of investors, which means there'll be the ability to cover each investor probably with more jobs.
Right. So I do see the advantages all over for increasing the minimum amount, which incidentally, Mark, I don't know if you know that that minimum amount was put there by Congress in 1990. So it's well overdue. And it currently has a buying power of 277,000. So it really is due for an uplift and a raise.
Whether the TEA goes up or not, and it sounds like it may go up for a number of reasons. In fact, the one that you just mentioned, Mona, when they originally put $500,000 in place, well, that was worth almost half of what that is today. And as Jeff mentioned, you know, of course, more money is going to create more induced jobs, whether that's linear or not. But let me ask you this one last question. Jeff, do you think the targeted employment area mechanism is going to go away? I realize that there may be changes in how some things are calculated and how you can use census tracts, but do you think that the targeted employment area program would go away?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't think targeted employment areas are going to go away, but I think what the drift is in the reform legislation is that it's going to make targeted employment areas be a much more special designation. I think with the reform legislation, if my crystal ball is right, is going to make TEA's projects a much more exclusive club than they've been recently. In the recent experience with the EB-5 program, targeted employment area projects have been the norm. They've been more than 90% of the total. All of the EB-5 reform legislation versions that have been discussed will restrict the ability of projects, particularly in the metro areas, to achieve targeted employment status. And so whether or not you agree with that or not, it looks like, you know, even the GAO report, the Government Accountability Office report, said that the fact that virtually all projects that enter the marketplace are targeted employment area qualifying projects talks about how they're not special anymore, that the original legislation that passed back in the early 90s indicated that target and employment areas were to not be the norm, that the original intent was to make them special cases, to have projects go to more capital-starved rural areas and areas of economic distress. I think we're going to find that any EB-5 legislation is probably going to put more restrictions on the ability of certain projects, probably the metropolitan area projects, to achieve targeted employment area status in an effort to try to level the playing field, because there is a risk difference between metro projects and rural projects, and the market perceives metro projects probably as less risky than the rural projects, although it's a very delicate balancing act between doing that and achieving that goal and not doing something that inadvertently reduces the activity in the program, because it's really been an excellent program for driving new capital investment and creating jobs in the U.S. at no cost to the taxpayer.
Yes, you're right, Jeff, at no cost to the taxpayer at all. This is a topic which we can speak about for hours and hours, and we are going to have another podcast relating to the job creation differences. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you very much. As usual, you're excellent. And Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Mona. Thank you for bringing Jeff on. Jeff, I have learned a lot about targeted employment areas, why it's important, and why it will continue to be important in the future. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome. An excellent discussion.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Or call the office at 212-233-7473. Don't worry about trying to write all this down, as it's already embedded in your podcast player of choice. The contact information and other valuable resources can be found there. I'd again like to thank Jeff Carr from EPR Economics for coming on and really discussing with us what targeted employment areas are and why they're important. Again, TEAs essentially lower the investment hurdle for EB-5 petitioners to invest in a project. There's a couple different ways you can get a TEA, such as a rural area, as well as the unemployment hurdle, and some of the intricacies with combining those census tracts with high unemployment areas. We talked a lot about targeted employment areas and how they can be defined as a rural area and you're locked in for at least a decade, as well as areas that may have high unemployment, and the type of analysis that's done to find the contiguous census tracts to merge together that shows whether you are in a targeted employment area or not. And it could be somewhat contentious. What's going to happen in the future? We don't know. But right now, the TEA investment hurdle is $500,000. And if it does go up in the future, it will most likely still be less than the overall EB-5 investment. Now, both Jeff, Mona, and I agree that a project should take advantage of a targeted employment area if it's able to. Be sure to join us on the next episode where we talk about raising EB-5 capital from a developer's perspective. Make sure you don't miss it by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.